this is just a mask that patients wear to protect their vulnerability, instead to see beyond the mask and get that this is a very fearful person.
Here's a question for you. What's the best way to have a long and prosperous career? I think it's not to have to retire early because of back pain. And that's where Dr. Eneco Ball comes in. Dr. Eneco Ball experienced back pain early in her career for many, many years, and it took years for her to find out what was going on. She eventually did get the right diagnosis and realized that it was a lot to do with her posture, it was a lot to do with work, and she was in the situation you guys are in right now, doing day-to-day dentistry, but not in the correct posture. Eneco was lucky to discover the Alexander technique, something she spent years studying and training to be able to teach dentists. This is something that helped her with her posture, understanding how her joints worked and how her body works and can sit and can make these actions without causing it stress. And it allowed her to practice dentistry for many years to come without the debilitating back pain she had for so many years. Of course, this is something that's important to us all because we all want to do dentistry without pain and problems. But something else that's really important to us all is dealing with anxious patients, and that's something Dr. Ball also covers in this conversation. She's got a real passion for managing stress, both from the patient and the dentist's point of view. We talk about how to listen to a patient and to really understand what's going on and to help them feel heard. Setting your own mindset so that you don't take things personally. And we talk about ways you can get through difficult appointments with anxious patients, not take on the stress yourself, but also help them get through and be happy at the end of the treatment. Eneco was generous with her time and we really appreciate it. So thank you, Eneco, for coming on the Dental Head Start podcast. Something I absolutely love is when I see people trying to give back to their community. BOQ Specialist feels the same way. They've developed the Future Focus Grant, which gives successful applicants $2,000 for their travel costs for overseas placement and $500 to spend in the community when they're there. If you're a dental student and you plan to travel outside Australia to do volunteer work, then you're eligible to apply for this grant. The successful applicants will also receive a GoPro so they can film the trip and inspire others to do the same thing. So if you're interested in applying for this grant, check out dentalheadstart.com/BOQ Specialist Grant for more details, eligibility criteria, and terms and conditions. Thank you, BOQ Specialist, for supporting dental students volunteering overseas and for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast. Make sure you get in quick. Applications close 30th of August 2019. So Dr. Eneco Ball, welcome to the Dental Head Start podcast. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, to diving into a few really important topics. Of course, your main thing is ergonomics and posture for dental clinicians, but also you teach on stress reduction for both the clinician and the patient, and I think they're both really important topics. So I wanted to start saying thank you for coming on, but also I want to get an idea of your opinion of how many dentists at the moment suffer with physical or emotional stress. And when I say suffer, I mean suffer outside of dentistry because of what they do in dentistry. How prevalent is that?
Well, first of all, thank you, David, for the invitation and the opportunity to speak with you and reach hopefully a lot of young dentists and dental students, especially because the earlier that dental students and dentists learn how to look after themselves, the better. The numbers are alarming, David. I am seeing almost 100% of incidence of chronic pain, occupational chronic pain among young dentists. When I started running my programs, I expected all the dentists to come and get some help, and most of my participants are young dentists barely out of dental school. And also I'm reading on Facebook, there are a number of dental groups, and also one in especially, I'm not sure if you've come across the mental block. Have you heard of this?
Yes, I have heard of it, yeah.
Dedicated to supporting dentists' emotional and mental wellness. And I'm reading frightening stories of how stressed and burnt out dentists are. And also people who come into the program. I'm running ergonomics and wellness programs. I was focusing only on the ergonomics aspect, and throwing in bits and pieces of self-management, self-care, patient and dentist calming techniques, because I learned that a long time ago. And as I was throwing in these extra bits to my participants, they all said, Aniko, we need a lot more of this. So yeah. Now I'm incorporating that as well.
That's fantastic. And it really is something that is so important. Both of these things, your physical body, you need that to be able to do the dentistry for, say, 30 or 40 years. But, of course, your emotional stability and confidence and happiness when you go home, all that stuff, it just plays such a big role in your personal life. And in the end, you know, we do dentistry often because we love it, but often because it is a job and it needs to then support the rest of our lives and allow us to do the things we do love to do. So, Aniko, how did you end up in dentistry? Tell us about where you grew up and your childhood and what led you towards dentistry.
I grew up in Budapest, Hungary, and came to Melbourne as a 14-year-old a long time ago, 1967, and then completed my high school studies in Melbourne and got into dentistry. I wanted to be in the medical dental field because I wanted to help people. However, I wanted to have a qualification that allowed me to work part-time and have a family. And I found dentistry to be perfect in that way. What I wasn't expecting was the tremendous physical, mental, emotional challenge that dentistry is. And I don't think that young students, when they decide to do dentistry, realize what they're getting into. And
absolutely. When you decided to do dentistry, you saw that this was something that would give you the opportunity to work part-time and give you that work-life balance. Did you find that to be the case when you got out?
I did. I practiced full-time for some years, and then when I started having a family and I have a beautiful daughter, I was able to work very part-time within kinder and school hours and work as much or as little as I wanted to. And for me, being a mother and being around my daughter and being able to attend her school functions was very important. So my practice was very close to home and it was convenient. It was exactly what I was hoping to set up as a work-life balance.
That's fantastic. It is a job. Dentistry, you know, it's got a lot of stresses and that's what we're going to get into today, both physical and emotional, but it also does allow us to have, to do those things that we might want to do. We can work part-time and still, afford to live a nice life. So that's so nice. What brought you guys, your family, early on out from Budapest?
Well, it's actually a sad story. My mother and I were one of the very few Hungarians to arrive here with a passport. Everyone else got out somehow and risked their lives to leave Hungary during the Aynkön communist period. My father died when I was very young, and my mother met and married a Hungarian bachelor who went back to Hungary for a visit and married my mother and adopted me formally in Hungary. At that time, it was very difficult to get out of Hungary. Australia was happy to have immigrants at that time. Unfortunately, before we left Hungary, and it took a year to get our passports, my second father, perfectly healthy, had a heart attack and died. And that was devastating. And my mother turned to me and said, well, people give their right arm to leave the country and go to a Western country like Australia, and perhaps I would have a better life. So we came, and it was very tough. And I did have a better life.
Yes, of course. That sounds like a really tough time for obviously for your mother as well as yourself. And you came from a country obviously speaking English as a second language.
No, I spoke no English at all.
How did you find nothing at all? Even I can't. I must admit, I truly couldn't imagine how difficult that would be. How was your schooling years, and then to get into dentistry and to succeed the way you did? How did you get through that?
It's a good question. So I came with no English, and also it was as if I was dropped in from Mars, coming from a communist country to 67 capitalism. And I learned that capitalism was bad. I was very brainwashed as a little communist. However, because my mother said to me we should come so that I could have a better future, I made sure that that sacrifice she made was worth it. So I pushed myself very hard to learn English and studied day and night and got into dentistry with high marks. And I pushed myself for a long time. It was decades later when I realized that there was a price to pay for that, and that was part of my own wellness journey.
Yes, of course, because when we're studying, we're putting ourselves in certain positions similar to dentistry as well, and we can get a lot of impacts both physically and emotionally. So that's a really interesting story, and I'll tell you what, that's very impressive to see what you've done, where you've come to. After, of course, school, you got into dentistry, Melbourne graduate. How was your first couple of years out after that?
It was challenging because this was at a time when there were either no female dental students or there might have been one or two per year. I was regularly mistaken for the dental nurse. In fact, one time a patient asked, "Is that the lady dentist running around in pajamas?" Because I had a matching top and pants as a uniform, and I regularly had to make sure people knew that I was the dentist. I would have this great big badge saying "Doctor," and even then, and people would ask me, "Now, are you sure you're strong enough to take out my tooth?" And I'd have to show them how strong my arm was.
Don't worry, Aniko. Sometimes people ask me. I'm fairly skinny dude. So so that would have been quite an interesting period. And, of course, being at a time where there were a few female dentists, how did you – you said you wore, obviously, a name badge. How did you – distinguish yourself or gain the respect of your patients in that time? Because a lot of dentists, I think now, you know, any graduate dentist, especially if they're from an undergraduate program, you know, we look pretty young. I'm from a postgraduate program, but I still look pretty young. And we have to, I guess, gain that respect. How did you go about that?
Well, what helped me was that I trained already as a teenager to manage the difficulties that life threw at me. I trained in self-hypnosis, and that helped me in my exams and helped me manage various difficult situations. And then when I was a dental student and I read studies done by previous dental students for their final year research project about the high rate of stress among dentists, stress-related illnesses, suicide rate, and also the fact that most dental patients were frightened and anxious, I realized that I needed to then further train in the use of hypnosis, not just for myself, but how to use that to calm my patients. And we can talk about that later. But what I found was that my communication skills and my calming skills through my hypnosis training made a huge difference, so that patients felt so comfortable with me that the fact that I was young as a female and I had an accent, so there were three different things working against me. And I ended up buying a practice of a retired Australian dentist whose patients thought it was really strange to have a person like me take over from this typically Australian dentist, but that built a very successful practice.
Yeah, I can well imagine. I think once you, anyone, if you're young, old, doesn't matter, but if you break through that initial rapport, they completely, like, it doesn't matter anymore. So sometimes you have that initial patient might look at you and think, "Are you sure? Are you old enough? Are you experienced enough?" But if you can, you know, one, be confident, two, communicate well, it doesn't matter very quickly. So that's really, I think that's really good advice. So you ended up owning that practice for, I guess, a number of years. How did your career develop from there?
And later on, remind me to go back to rapport building, because that is definitely so important whenever you want to touch on that. I married a dentist, and together we ran a practice. Initially, that practice near home was just for me to tinker around And when we had a child, I would be there. We never expected it to grow as much as it did because it was a very small practice. And in a very short time, my husband had to sell his practice in the city and join me because the practice was just growing. We were building trust and patients came from everywhere. So for a while, I was a general dentist, and then I became very interested. And I also saw a lot of patients who were anxious and even phobic, and I was using calming techniques with them. And I used to train other dentists as well how to do that. And then I met a professor from America who was running workshops in periodontics, and I became so interested that I left general dentistry and focused on non-surgical periodontics for a while. Then I became interested in dental sleep medicine. So I've done a number of things, and at some point I took time out from dentistry to do my own further healing, and there was a lot of loss and grief that I needed to deal with, which I didn't as a child because I was so busy trying to achieve and do well. So I've done a lot of different things in dentistry. And throughout the years of practicing dentistry, I had a very sore neck, back and shoulder and hip issues, and everything hurt. Because the one thing I didn't know is how do you get yourself over there to gain access to the patient's mouth? What do you do with your body? So I just did whatever I could, literally twisted myself into a pretzel.
Yeah, yeah. So that's obviously something we really do want to cover. And I think let's get into a bit of that now. We're going to come back to stress reduction for patients, for the dentist, rapport, all of that. But tell us, what were you doing in hindsight that caused most of the discomfort you felt?
I am a right-handed person, and this is what most right-handed dentists do. I sat somewhere between 12 and 10 o'clock position, and I twisted over to my right side. I twisted my spine, and then I bent my neck to look into the mouth. And then I had my left shoulder and elbow up in the air. And this is what I see just about every right-handed dentist do. Left-handers do the same on the other side. And I worked like that for hours at a time, as you know, and I had a lot of long appointments. I seeked all kinds of help, physical therapists, doctors, specialists. Nobody actually looked at what I was doing so many hours per day. They said, oh, Nico, you've got great posture. When I asked, could it be my posture? And I said, no. So they just worked on different body parts. But as you know, unless you change what you're doing, nothing's going to improve in the long term.
Nothing changes if nothing changes. And it's so important to get to the cause of the problem, not just symptomatically fix or address things. We should know that as dentists, I guess. So where were you feeling the pain?
I had very sore neck already as a dental student. I had very stiff neck. I could barely turn. I had to twist my whole body whenever I was parking the car. My back, lower back especially, left shoulder, burning pain first thing in the morning, even after a restful weekend, because the shoulder and elbow were up. And also I had a lot of sciatica, hip issues.
Yeah, hips as well. Okay. So I imagine that to be quite draining, and I'm sure that took away a lot of the passion. If you're feeling pain when you're doing dentistry, you're going to be less passionate about it or less wanting to go to work. Did it impact on your drive for dentistry?
Very much, and it impacted on the quality of my life. About there were periods when I had to wear slip-on shoes because I couldn't manage to bend down to reach my shoelaces, and there were times when I had to cancel patients. I just couldn't move. I was actually a hopeless case by my doctors and physical therapists.
Wow, that's so it's a big turnaround if they were to say something like that, to say that you have no real hope. But then you found the Alexander technique and posture and changing the cause of this pain. Tell us a bit about all of that.
Well, when I was declared a hopeless case, and I certainly felt terrible, it was a very low point in my life, and I was told I should have spinal surgery and I'll probably live my life on anti-inflammatory medication, pain medication. And I just had a strong belief that there must be something out there that could help me. I've always had that belief deep inside. And I literally prayed for help. It was at a time when I wasn't into praying. And I came across a book in a bookstore that talked about the Alexander technique and described some of my symptoms. And I thought this must be what will help me. And I had a patient who a few days later said, oh, I'm a teacher of the Alexander technique. And I've been seeing him for years, but he never told me that's what he was doing. And I may not have heard it. And within one or two sessions, my head that couldn't turn, and at least 30 physiotherapists did their best to try and turn my head, I actually learned where the head sits on top of the spine and how it could turn. So I thought there must be something in this. And I had a number of sessions with an Alexander teacher. It helped me enormously. I didn't fully understand what I was learning, but it helped. And then I decided about 3 years later that I need to put the time in, and it's a lot of time, in-person training, not online. And I decided that I need to help my colleagues and save them from the kind of suffering, and I really suffered a lot, that is actually preventable, but no one seems to know.
Something that gets left out of, well, I would say it's, I always say this in the podcast, I often say left out of dental school, but really they tried to teach us from being a, you know, just a public person to a dentist. It's amazing what they do, but at the same time, they can only focus so much on each different topic. We had a few people who were very influential in the posture scene, I guess, but at the same time, I didn't really take away what I should have been doing from that. And so that's, I get what you're teaching and what you're trying to spread the message is really getting people to make those changes that work for you as a dentist. So you learnt the Alexander technique as a teacher. How long did that take, and what components, what does that teach you to teach, I guess?
Before I answer that, I just want to go back to something you said, David. What I found is that when there is any instruction, advice given on posture, it's usually outside in information, which is already better than nothing. But people will say you need to bend at whatever degree, or you should sit in 11 or 12 or 10 o'clock position, and you should do this or that. And that's going from the outside. What I teach is going inside out, learning biomechanical design principles so that you understand what your body can and can't do. And then you organize everything from that and set up your position and everything else according to that. So that's an inside-out approach, and I've not come across that until, and we can talk more about that, but that's the very big difference and distinction.
Definitely.
Does that make sense? I'm just wondering if I'm making it clear enough.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, because that's exactly the experience I've had where people, you know, they suggest, oh, sit in this position or do this. You're from the outside in, but I'm not thinking from my physiology or my exact positioning of those joints. And I know we'll get into the joints that can will pivot and others that can't. And that those differences make, of course, a big difference. Let's get into that, actually. What when you say from the inside out, what kind of things are you suggesting to people?
I call it Inner Ergonomics 101. And just to define the terms,
yes.
When I was training, and it's I did a four-year part-time training, over 1,600 hours in person, and continued to do practice part-time dentistry.
Wow.
Then I did another 1,000 hours training on how do you translate it to dentistry. So it didn't happen overnight. And it occurred to me that there is so much research and development that's been going on for decades in dentistry, and yet no one is looking at what we're doing inside of ourselves. So I've come up with the terms outer ergonomics, meaning everything that's not you. And that's very important, the equipment, the surgery layout, the instruments, and often what is called ergonomic design is not. Often the designers have no idea about biomechanical design principles. And then what I'm teaching is knowing how to how and the way to do things, how to bend, how to hold, what to do with your body. I'm calling that inner ergonomics, efficiency in posture and movement of the person, the operator. So that's what I'm teaching. And what I always talk about is inner ergonomics 101, the absolute basics, and this is not rocket science. I teach where the very important joints are, not all the joints, and that's essentially functional anatomy. And I teach which joints are for bending and which are not. And again, these are just the very important joints. And what surprises me, David, is that all of us have done a year at least of anatomy, and I did very well in my second year anatomy. And yet I didn't know where my important joints are, for example, the hip joint or the arm joint or where the head sits on top of the spine. And what has surprised me even more is that I've talked to doctors and even ear, nose, and throat surgeon. One came into my program and he could operate on patients and knew every joint where it was on his patients but on himself. And same for doctors, they don't know it. So we don't learn the blueprint for posture and movement patterns.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think of it that way. And tell us a bit about those key joints and where they are actually in our body and where we should be pivoting with those joints.
Well, it's very important to know where they are on ourselves. And before I do that, I just want to say that what researchers have found is that we all have an image or a mental representation of where important joints are, and it's called the body map. And unfortunately, these body maps form when we were little children playing with teddy bears, Barbie dolls, and toy soldiers, and you know how inaccurate they are. So updating the body map is important because we move according to where we think the joint is, and then we are moving in harmful ways. So I usually go through the joints by starting at the top joint. And at one stage, I used to ask people to show me, to point to where they think their head sits on top of the spine. And it was so embarrassing for everyone, especially doctors, not to know. And they all pointed way different to where the joint is that I stopped asking. I thought, I need to know this. So the head sits on top of the spine approximately at the height of the ear. So if you put an imaginary rod in your ears, that's the point of rotation for the head. The occipital condyles move almost like a rocking chair on top of the top vertebra, the atlas. And that's how we look up and down. And there's only about a 10-degree freedom to look down from that point. Then immediately below that is the next joint, C1 and C2, the atlas and axis, and we can look to the left and right because there's a little rod or the demis formed by the second vertebra, and that's a joint where we can pivot the head around. And then what no one seems to know or think about ever is that because these two joints are so close, you could say, practically speaking, below the height of the ear, all the way down the whole spine, every single intervertebral joint is a gliding joint. They're not designed for pivoting or hinging, even though we can do that with it because we've got these this between each vertebra, which we can squeeze and squash and distort. If we do that for a brief moment or two as we move and dance, it's okay because we keep coming back to neutral and the disc can rebound and regain their shape. But in dentistry, we hold those twisted, bent positions for long periods, and that's when we do damage.
That's something that's really interesting, to think of it from a functional and to think literally about the joints. If you're bending your whole neck and body forward to look into the mouth, you're squashing the vertebral disc. And if you're squashing the disc all day, every day, you can, of course, you're going to have pain and problems. It's something that, it's funny, the way you're telling me now and I'm thinking about it and it's kind of just making it so much more real. I'm going to improve my posture after this, possibly come to one of your courses as well. So the head sits at the level of the ears, and that's where we can tilt, but only about 10 degrees. So how do we see into the mouth?
Well, first of all, so I really stress this point that the spine isn't designed for bending. We have a wonderful pivot joint called the hip joint. And and that's what's designed to transport the head and torso forward towards the patient. And we'll come back to loops later, but essentially this is something else that's not known, is that unless you're using an operating microscope or the Pentax loops, you cannot expect to sit upright and look into the patient's mouth without damaging your spine. It's just impossible. But let's come back to loops later, if you wish. So people need to know where their hip joint is. And when I have asked people to point to where it is, no one ever got it right. So now I don't ask them. I just show them. So if you draw a line from the inside to the outside of the thigh along the on the pants line, roughly that's one of the ways that I explain it. It's halfway along that line. So it's much further in than people think. And again, they've done experiments where they got people to walk according to where they think their hip joint is, and they walk very different than when they actually know where it is. And so we move according to our body map, and we got to update it to the correct position. So it's the hip joint. So people need to pivot forward. Now, this is something that I recommend dentists practice away from dentistry, because if you're not practicing moving well and holding postures well away from dentistry, there's no way you can implement it in dentistry. So if you're sitting at your desk or your dining room table or kitchen table and you're reaching for a glass or anything on in front of you, if you bend your spine, then you'll be doing that in dentistry. You need to pivot forward at the hip joint and then reach for things. So you can see me pivoting. Of course, your audience won't see me. And of course...
Yes. And unfortunately, the audience can't see me sitting not so well. Annika, we'll talk about that after.
Now, in order to pivot forward at the hip joint, whether it's in your home or in your surgery, if you're sitting right on top of the table or right on top of the patient chair and literally touching the edge of the headrest or the side of the chair, then you don't have the space to pivot your torso forward. And this is something I see all the time among dental practitioners, is that they are too close to the patient. So they need to move back just a fraction, enough to pivot the torso forward. You need a little bit of space, which brings me to a very important point, which I realized only in the last 2 years, is that there are some dental surgeries which are set up without having sufficient space behind the patient chair. And I want to warn young dentists when they're looking for a job or if they're already working somewhere where the surgery space is too small. If you can't, with the patient chair fully supine, horizontal, and with the dentist sitting behind the patient chair in 12 o'clock position or any position behind the chair, if there's not enough room between the back of the chair and the back of the wall or the cabinetry so that the dentist can move the chair back just enough to pivot forward at the hip joints, then it's going to damage the dentist's spine. And I've already recommended at least to one dentist to leave his current job because there wasn't enough space and the owner of the practice wasn't going to make any changes.
Right. So how much space do we need behind a chair?
So taken from the edge of the headrest with the chair horizontal, there needs to be at least 70 centimeters, between 70 to 90 centimeters. Probably 80 is a good number, but minimum 70. What's very unfortunate, David, is that this is one measurement that's missing in the guidelines that are published by the Dental Association. Everything else is written as an essential measurement in the guidelines, and this is missing, and I've not been able to get that in there, although I've tried.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you're successful in that, because that's clearly going to make a big impact on those clinicians working in those practices. And often I would think the practices with those surgeries set up a little too small, perhaps, are usually the associate surgery, not so much the principal's surgery. So it's the new graduate that suffers, and it's the, it's people that listen to this podcast. So very important tips. That's really, really great. When you were saying, we need to pivot at the hips. We need to move a little bit further back. I assume the legs and the support for our body is very important as well. Where should our legs be?
Very good point. So whether you're sitting in an ordinary chair or especially doing dentistry, because each leg weighs about 12 kilos or more, it's really important to allow the weight of the leg to be taken by the floor. So it's very important for the feet to be underneath the knees. So if people are tucking their legs in under the chair or crossing their legs, for example, it means that you're not giving that weight over to the floor. And then the lower back muscles, movement muscles have to brace. And that's harmful to the body. Movement muscles are designed for a quick movement, not for a lengthy contraction. And also in sitting, the knees are designed to point outwards. The head of the femur rotates laterally or distally as we bend the leg. And guys tend to sit pretty well with their legs falling out, but women learn to have their knees together because that's the ladylike way of sitting. And unfortunately, it's very bad advice because that requires movement muscles to activate to hold the legs together, which are meant to be going outwards. So I teach female dentist to sit unladylike and make sure they wear the right clothes. You can't wear mini skirts.
No, definitely not. But you can have a long career and a bit more comfortable. That's really good. So as you were saying that, I uncrossed my legs and let my legs support my weight. So I'm thinking about what you're saying right now, of course.
Because you know what happens when you cross your legs? You are loading one hip joint. And it's gravity is always acting vertically on the body. That's another thing that I certainly never thought about and no one does. And you want to be sitting and standing in balance. Having weight, you should be sitting on your sit bones. A lot of people sit on the back of the sacrum, on their tailbone, and that means they're reversing their lumbar curve. So we need to sit on the sit bones, and evenly. When we twist off to the right, not only are we doing damage to the spine, but we're loading one hip joint unevenly, and that has a lot of consequences. So thinking about a geometry of alignment with gravity acting on us makes a difference.
Yeah, definitely. And when you think about it that way, of course, it makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to try and recap some of this. We're saying sitting on your sit bone, so sitting without bending your lower lumbar spine, then you're tilting forward slightly from the hips, not bending your spine so you can see into the mouth. You're also bending your head at the level of the ears, and it's only a very small amount. It's not significant or not a lot. And making sure your legs are slightly apart and supporting their own weight underneath you. Does that all sound right?
Yes, except there is a lot more to it. First of all, you need to start with as before you even think of pivoting forward, you need to make sure that your spine is uncompressed. And most of us are sitting in a kind of a collapsed way and the spine is compressed. If you then pivot forward, you're taking a compressed spine and distort it even further. So it's a little bit like with a car, you need to turn on the ignition. Unfortunately, we can turn on the ignition and move in very bad postures to start with. But there is a way of activating the deep postural muscles, which are slow twitch, slow in firing, and they don't tire easily. And they're designed to hold us up against gravity. And if we're not activating it, then the body is held upright by movement muscles, which are not designed for lengthy contraction. And so before you even think of looking into your patient's mouth, I teach dentists how to apply what is called directional thinking by thinking that your sit bones are going through the seat but you're not moving, you're just thinking, and you're thinking that your spine is holding you up but not moving up, because people usually do a pull-up, which is a forced upright using movement muscles, which is unsustainable. That's why people, when they see me, they quickly pull up and say, oh, Nico, I must have good posture. Then in a short time, they collapse because the movement muscles cannot sustain that. And most of us are in that cycle of collapse and pull up. Mm. So I teach people how to think up without pulling up. And I talk about research that shows, because it sounds like it's magical thinking, but by thinking up along your spine and thinking that your sit bones are going through the seat, thinking that your heel is going through the floor, what you're actually doing is turning off the firing of unnecessary movement muscles. The spine can regain its natural length, and you are activating deep postural muscles. Also, people need to make sure that they don't have their chin up. The head weighs over 5 kilos. And if you have a chin up, head up kind of posture, which women learn, head up, chin up, shoulders back, which is very bad advice, on top of the knees together, then the over five kilo weight is crushing down on the spine. So you want to start movement and pivoting forward by activating your deep postural muscles. Make sure that your head is slightly forward rotated on top of the spine. And of course, it's easy to explain this and teach this when I have people in person and they receive kinesthetic guidance and I demonstrate. And a lot of people have a forward head posture, which is also very bad. So you want to start off organizing yourself from the inside out before you even start pivoting. Then once that's done, directional thinking applied, and I have a series of instructions on that, then you pivot forward without trying to look into the mat. First, you need to transport the torso and the head forward just a little bit. And then you look down into the patient's mouth, because if people try and look down as they're upright into the patient's mouth and then pivot, they've already bent their neck.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. You talk about a lot of things that resonate with me, actually, which is when we talk about posture in the past, I've always felt like the perfect postural positions, and I'm using quotation marks, are uncomfortable. And I realize that's because I'm using fast twitch muscles, movement muscles, to support this upright stance that I think sounds right, but I always find it uncomfortable, and that's why. So the actual correct posture is quite different, and that sounds, it's really something that we should all learn for sure. I see something, I'm going to change the direction a little bit, but I saw some statistics that we see chronic pain in about 80% and severe pain in about 25% higher in young dentists. Why do you think it's higher in young dentists?
I have two reasons that I believe, and I was very surprised to see that young dentists are in so much pain. The first one that I thought was the reason, and I'm sure that that's a big part of it, is that the young generation has grown up using mobile devices, especially the mobile phone. And without knowing that taking your head towards the mobile phone does damage to the spine, because as you remember, we spoke of the fact that below the height of the ears, there are no pivot or hinge joints. We have a wonderful hinge joint called the elbow to bring the device to the head rather than the head to the spine. So the cervical spine is literally reversed, and a lot of damage is done when young people or anyone of any age does that to their spine. And unfortunately, American neurosurgeons are reporting an alarming rise in the need for cervical surgery among young people for this reason. So for some time, I thought it was the mobile devices. Yeah. What I realized about 2 years ago, because I check dentist loops in all the workshops, both in my own workshops or when I come out to dental practices and train the whole team, what I realized was that the declination angle, the angle at which the magnification loops are mounted onto a frame or glass, is not sufficient And I found that 100% of dentists were coming into my programs with the wrong declination angle. And of course, what that means is that you have to bend your neck. You, even if you pivot forward at the hip joint, you still can't look into the mouth safely.
It sets up a situation where it's impossible to do it properly. So I know there's a lot to talk about with loops, and I think we might leave a lot of that for another day. In fact, if anyone is interested, the Newbie Dentist podcast interviewed Aneka Ball and talk in some depth about loops, and I think that's a really interesting listen as well. So I recommend people hear that from that podcast, if not from us in the future. You raised a really good point, and something that I realized quite a few years ago. I used to travel for 2 hours to get to a job, and this was before dentistry. I worked for a surgeon in Brisbane, but I lived on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. So I would sit on the train for an hour and a half after driving for half an hour, and often I would read in that time, read a Kindle or a book with my head down. And I found, one, I got more neck issues, which is kind of obvious because my posture was terrible. But I also found that I was grinding a lot more after doing that. Is there an association with bruxism and posture?
It is an area that I can't make a definitive statement as to why, although I have worked with bruxism and in dental sleep medicine, and some people say, yes, there is, and I'd like to leave that to further analysis.
Yeah. It's an interesting thought because I know that's a bit left field, and that was from personal experience. Well, I grind anyway, so I just wonder, because I do notice it to be worse when I have poor posture. So perhaps there's an association, perhaps not.
Well, there is an association in that. So the temporomandibular joint is extremely close to where the head sits on top of the spine, the atlanto-occipital joint. And what I've seen with all cases, whether it's dental patients or anyone else, is that when there are tight neck muscles, when there is bending at the wrong joints along the cervical spine, of course, there's tension everywhere, and it's going to be accompanied by increased jaw muscle tension. So, yes, there is definitely a link. And I used to teach all my patients who were bruxing to learn to relax their whole body and notice what was happening during the day. Because, of course, bruxism is worse during the night. But people who brux during the night are doing a clenching during the day and teaching mindfulness of what their jaw was doing, whether their teeth were touching when they weren't eating, and what was happening to their neck, shoulder, and the rest of the body was very useful.
Can you elaborate a bit on what you would actually tell your patients? For two reasons, because I try to do the same thing, and I'd like to with my patients, but also with myself. I do exactly that. I grind at night, and sometimes I catch myself clenching during the day. What would you discuss with your patient? What would you talk them through with positioning their jaw and being mindful of their position?
I would ask them a question, and the answer was always no. Did you know that your teeth are not supposed to touch during the day when you're not chewing or talking? And that go, really? And I would say to them that it's really hard to tell if your teeth are touching. And one of the ways that you can learn what your jaw rest position is, where there isn't any extra muscle activity on the jaw opening or closing muscles, is to do one of two things, and I would go through both. One was just to say M, like in Mississippi, and I'd say, just say M and leave your lips, teeth, mouth, tongue where it is at the end of M, and there's always a little gap. And I'd say, now this is the rest position for your jaw, and notice where your tongue is when you do that. And the tongue is usually down behind the lower front teeth on the floor of the mouth, the tip of the tongue. And the upper surface of the tongue is not touching the palate. Then I ask them to close so that the teeth are lightly touching. And what they'll notice is that the tongue is now touching the palate. Okay, are you testing that? Because the tongue, of course, travels with lower jaw. And I say, well, any time that you notice that your tongue is touching or anywhere near the palate, you can assume for sure that your jaw-closing muscles are now activated and you are doing some amount of clenching. And that was very useful. Another way that I got my patients to keep practicing during the day is to take a breath through the nose and do just a little sigh through the mouth and say, you know, that kind of sound. And they can do that quietly or loud. If they were on their own, they could just go, and get them to really sigh it out. Now, there is actually a relaxation technique that's taught in yoga. And I would say to my patients throughout the day, if you can do that, either just say the letter M or especially throughout the day, do the sighing softly or loud. That's a way that you bring down your inner temperature because things happen. And if you're constantly bringing down your temperature and it helps you release your muscle tension throughout the body, and even I would get them to just shake their hands and do a little sway if possible, then they are looking after themselves. And I'm a great one on giving practical examples and analogy. And I say, on a hot day, you don't wait for your house to get boiling hot. You turn on the air conditioning as the temperature rises. So practice this throughout the day. And if you notice that you're in an annoying, frustrating situation, assume that the temperature has risen and do lots of that.
That's really interesting. The concepts there are so important for me personally, but also for my patients. So I appreciate you sharing that. That's really great. Speaking of, you know, this stress and this situation where we can, you know, become a bit tense, can you tell us a bit about this? Because I know you're quite interested in stress reduction for both patients and dentists, particularly from early on in your career, you started treating the anxious and phobic patient, and it became a bit of a niche for you. How did you end up in that niche?
Well, when I found out in fourth year dentistry that I was about to graduate into this highly stressful profession, and I saw the statistics, I didn't want to be one of those statistics. So I trained initially in very complicated hypnosis techniques, which I realized some years later that it didn't need to be so complicated. And I now teach very, very simple techniques to dentists for themselves. And I used it with my patients, and I recommend that it can be used with dental patients. And so there are layers and layers to this. The first thing is for dentists to realize that quite often, there is a particular hostile, unpleasant behavior that may be coming our way, which is not personal, but it's coming personally at you. For example, I remember as a very young dentist, patients would say to me, nothing personal, doc, but I hate seeing dentists. I hate being here. I'd rather be wherever. And it's hard not to take that personally because it seems so personal. And dentists often take it personally and it makes you feel terrible. And I like the example of when you go out into the rain, although you get personally wet, the rain isn't trying to rain on you personally. It rains on everyone. It's a good example, isn't it?
That's fantastic, Melissa.
So and I really want to say this especially to young dentists and dental students, because unless you understand this, you will take things personally. And also to understand that what seems to be a prickly, hostile, at times unpleasant outer from a patient is actually covering a very frightened, anxious person underneath. And rather than get our ego defense reacting against the mask, because this is just a mask that patients wear to protect their vulnerability, instead to see beyond the mask and get that this is a very fearful person. And I came up with this really good thing, David, when I graduated. At that time, I don't know if you ever saw these ads for Vegemite. This was a long time ago that they talked about little Vegemites. Did you see those ads?
I think so. It rings a bell, yeah.
So I decided, I think I must have been only a year out, and I thought, I was actively thinking of ways to look after myself, and I noticed this pattern, and I didn't want to react to that outer behavior. So as soon as I saw a difficult, unpleasant patient, I would say, here comes an unhappy Vegemite. And that would activate my compassion rather than any self-defense where I'd get really annoyed with them and I'd start getting anxious within myself, thinking they don't like me. And I just then apply my calming technique to this unhappy Vegemite. And that was the code word. Comes an unhappy Vegemite, and immediately it stopped me from taking it personally.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic way to actually manage that, is to have this kind of almost a name for the patient in that situation, but it makes you instantly think, all right, it's not them, they're just, it's this, it's cloak of fear. And that's something I've read a blog before. I think this is really, really important, that when we see a patient who's angry in some way or particularly quiet in some way or acting a bit strange in some way, it's almost always a sign that they're very anxious and that they're it's changing their, you know, it's changing their personality. We're not meeting the real them because they're anxious. It's a cloak. I think it should activate our empathy and understanding, and we should take a bit more time with those patients, not the opposite. We should not, you know, push them away or feel that they're trying to purposely hurt us in any way. So that's fantastic advice. I think that's really great.
Well, it comes down to communication skills, David, and one of the things I in what's called passive and active listening or reflective listening, where you're trying to walk in the other person's shoes and make them feel heard. And there were many, many situations where I don't think would have had a very good ending if I couldn't use that. I learned it as part of my parent effectiveness training when I was a young mother, and it's been very helpful with my patients. So, for example, when a patient comes in and says, oh, my God, you're going to charge this much for this piece of some four-letter word.
Yeah.
and like, what do you do? And if you start defending yourself, you're just escalating the situation. So reflective listening is about getting into the patient's shoes. And I would go, and I got this, for example, when I was working in dental sleep medicine. How could I charge for that bit of plastic, for example? And I would go, oh my goodness, if I thought that this was just some piece of plastic, I would be outraged that dentists could charge. Like, I get on the same train as my patients. You know, the ships that pass by in the night? Unless we get on the same train with our patient, we can't do anything. So I try to come from their perspective. And as soon as I say something like that, acknowledging that, yeah, I would think the same if I thought that. It's like you take, the lid has been taken off, the steam goes, and suddenly they can hear you. Or I've had people who thought, oh my God, when I was working in periodontics, for example, and this is something that I really want to say, I'm glad I have the opportunity to say, the word clean should be deleted from dental vocabulary. Because where the dentist doing periodontal treatment, even if it's just scaling and prophy, or the hygienist, they are not cleaning ladies or cleaners. And patients rightly can say, well, why should I pay so much for cleaning? I don't have a dirty mouth. I learned through wonderful training in communication with the professor from America that I trained with for many years. And I say to patients, we're removing infection that's formed above and below your gum line, some of it in a soft form, some of it in a crystallized form. And when it's not removed, your immune system goes to war against it. And unfortunately, it's a war that it always loses.
That's a fantastic way of explaining.
Do you like that?
I'm going to use that.
So you're not cleaning. You are removing infection, which has huge consequences for the immune system. And we know that there's a cascading reaction and inflammatory consequences for the rest of the body. So when we book you in for this appointment, whether it's with the dentist or the hygienist, we're removing infection. This is infection control. And we are reducing the burden on your immune system. So then that's very different. I think it's so disrespectful to dentists and hygienists to call it anything but. So anyway, one time I had a patient who the receptionist told me was absolutely jumping up and down at the fee that he was going to be charged for seeing me. And he had, of course, periodontal disease. And I knew that. And I, when he came in, I said, oh, I'm just so glad that even though you thought it was a lot of money for seeing me, you still came. And it gave him an opportunity to tell me what he thought. And I acknowledged him for that. And then I began to educate him about what I was doing. And of course, he was told he would come for a clean. Well, I would too. And I would say so. I'd be mad if someone wanted to charge that much for cleaning my teeth. They're not dirty. So getting on the patient's wavelength is really helpful.
Breaking down that barrier, really, you know, because they, I guess when they say something like that, there's anxiety that, and there's financial anxiety. There's all these reasons that they say it. But they get, usually, I think a patient would go into that in an almost an aggressive way. And if you can then step onto their side of the fence and agree and then discuss, you break down that aggression and that barrier. That's really, that's great advice. I really like that.
And even commenting, if you get someone who's really upset and angry, just reflective listening is commenting on what you see. I get the feeling or I can really see that this is something that's bothering or upsetting. And the other aspect is to start bringing down your voice tone. So as you're speaking, can you still hear me okay? So slowing down the pace at which you speak, taking some audible breaths near the patient, that in itself is a calming technique. And I teach this in my ergonomics and wellness program, is how do you calm yourself and your patient without seemingly doing any hocus pocus, just by bringing down your voice tone, talking slowly. That has a hypnotic effect. I was trained in conversational indirect hypnosis, which just through not saying I'm going to count from 1 to 10 and you're going to go down a stairs, you know, traditional hypnosis does.
I was going to ask about that.
I was initially trained in that and I thought that doesn't have a really easy application in dentistry. And luckily I came across an American approach, which was conversational hypnosis. And through distractions, through using your voice tone, and you can hear as I'm now talking to you and I'm demonstrating this. And I would talk to my patients, explaining what we're going to do, but using this kind of speaking where I just slow right down. And I had to be careful. My nurses would regularly go off into a hypnotic trance. So I warned them how to stay away.
Yes, that's really interesting. And that makes so much sense. Like just hearing you say that in that way, honestly, like has an effect. It really does. It makes you slow down. It makes you focus. It makes you, you know, control. Where, with learning that, you've actually done a, is it a clinical diploma in hypnosis? Is that right?
I did. And that was training me in the traditional approach, which isn't so applicable. I then trained with American hypnotherapists and also I trained in meditation and various techniques. And the simplest of simple techniques that I now teach is something as simple as the following. And by the way, this is a technique where I can take an impression on a patient who is a really bad gagger and tells me that he or she can't have an impression taken. And this is the following. And this is a technique that you can use for yourself, and I use it constantly for myself. And I use it with others, and I teach dentists to do this. So it's the simple technique is the following. I say, and you can do this with me, and your listeners can do this as well. Without changing the way you're breathing, without doing anything, just notice the next breath that you take. Just notice the way that the breath comes in and the breath goes out, whether you feel the temperature or just a sensation, or you just think you can sense it, it doesn't matter. So just notice the next in-breath, and notice the out-breath. Notice the chest rising and falling with every breath. And then just imagine or think that you could soften your breath and soften your body with every breath you take. So going over that again, and this is the way I'd be speaking to myself silently or to my patient, really slowly bring the voice tone. So just notice whatever way you can, because some people think they can't notice anything. Just notice or pay attention to the next breath. Notice the in-breath and notice the out-breath. Notice the chest rising and falling with every breath you take. And then imagine that you could soften the breath and soften the body with every breath you take. Can you feel how that brings down the temperature?
Absolutely. It slows you down. It concentrates your mind.
Yes. Yeah.
I find that to be very similar to a lot of meditative techniques, particularly guided meditation. Are they intimately intertwined?
Very much so. And if I have someone who tells me that they are a gagger, before I start, I ask them if they like to walk by the sea or are they a mountain person, and then I add a bit more to it.
Yeah.
And I suggest that they imagine that they're breathing in with every breath. So I go through what I just did with you first a couple of times, and then I'd add, and imagine that you're breathing in mountain fresh air, pine smell, or breathing in the freshness and saltiness of the sea breeze, and then breathing out with every breath, any discomfort, any lack of ease. You use the in-breath to breathe in what you wish, and you use the out-breath to release whatever you wish to let go of. So I do a bit of additional imagery, and I really get them to focus on my voice. And I sound, although very calm and soft, also in a way authoritative, so that they hear my voice and not think that they're going to be sick.
Yeah, they're controlled by that. And so I hear when you say that, so you're breathing in things that they want or like, but you're also using a lot of description and you're using sensation, so smell, touch, hear what you can hear, etc. So you're creating a picture for them at the same time.
Yes, although I like to be very permissive. Some people say to me they can't visualize, so I let them know that there's no way they can fail this. I usually go through a range of you can think, imagine, you can hear, you can pretend that you can see. It doesn't matter how, any which way you do. So I usually, this is from my training in conversational hypnosis, that there was no way that someone could fail it. Whereas in the traditional, listen to my voice, do as I say, there's a lot of resistance.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think some patients, if they feel they are going to fail at doing it or it's not going to work for them, then it won't work for them because they kind of put up a wall from the start. So if you give them permission to experience it any way they want to experience it or any way that they will experience it, then that, I guess, allows them to go with whatever happens.
Very much so. And even as the patient is almost ready to throw up, I'll say, oh, and you're doing so well. Oh, wonderful. You know, and I still use that voice tone and reassuring. That is amazing. You know, that's hardly speaking. Because what you're doing really is activating endorphin release.
Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting technique. It's something I think people, everyone's different in the way they would use that for their patients. And I think it takes a little bit of practice and a little bit of experience to do that well. But that's great advice and something I will try to use to a certain extent in my practice as well. Let's talk a little bit about stress reduction for the dentist. Because when we have these patients that might, you know, not want to have an impression taken or might be fearful or might have financial anxiety possibly for good reason. It puts a lot of impact on us and sometimes we carry that on our shoulders home. What advice do you have for young graduates who do experience this stress?
Well, my first recommendation is to have built-in smoke alarm. You know, if you don't know there is smoke, you can't deal with the fire. And learning and being very familiar with what you feel like when you are stressed and what you feel like when you are not stressed. So you need to learn that contrast. So and again, this is something I teach in my courses, is I recommend that people do homework where they notice whenever, let's say, you're driving along the freeway and a car changes lanes in front of you without indicating. Notice what happens in your body. And usually, you know, you might have sweaty palms, your breathing rate changes, your heart rate changes, you might feel tightness. Just notice where in your body you feel those sensations, or somebody drives you nuts, or this difficult patient. Just notice what your body feels like. Your tummy might be in knots. And it's so invisible that people don't notice it. And then also, when you're feeling wonderful, when you're whether petting your dog or holding your child or someone makes you feel good or it's a beautiful day, notice what your throat, what your chest, what your hands, what your tummy feels like, so that you've got that contrast. And then you will notice, it will stand out and become a smoke alarm when you notice that tightness in the chest or the breathing rate. And Am I explaining it clearly enough?
Yeah, definitely.
You can only apply stress management techniques if you know that you need to. So these are, I call them the smoke alarm.
I think that's something that's easy to do, is to literally just not recognize how stressed you are. You know, go through life and you have this level of stress that's unnecessarily high, but perhaps you just think it's normal.
Exactly.
So I think that's great advice.
Well, you need to know when to apply. That's why we need smoke alarms in every house and apartment, so that we know and we can act. And then there are various techniques. One of them, and this technique that I described, and the short of it is notice the in-breath and the out-breath, notice chest rising and falling, and soften the breath, soften the body. So it's that simple. I use that for myself, and I recommend that anytime people notice that the temperature is rising or there's the smoke alarm, just apply that. And what happens is that when we're stressed, every cell in your body is literally bathing in stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol types. In a split second, you can change that to, you can have an endorphin release, and then your whole system, every cell is bathing in endorphin. And your skeletal muscles release, your blood pressure lowers, you can think better. When we are stressed, it's called the fight, flight, freeze. Our thinking mind freezes. We can't even think clearly. We can't make decisions well, nothing works. And it's, especially if it's sustained, it's very harmful. One of the other ways that I highly recommend that people manage stress, we have a lot of time pressure in dentistry. There's a clock and we have patients booked in, and we suddenly look at the time and you go, oh my God, I'm going to run late. And then again, fight, flight, freeze. We can't think. Everything is awash with adrenaline. A thinking mind goes offline. I have a wonderful motto that I apply, and it works. It sounds magical, but I recommend everyone tries it. And again, I teach this. If you say to yourself, I have time, but you say it like this, I have time, quietly to yourself, and repeat it several times, even when you do not have time, what happens is that there is an instant endorphin release, your thinking mind comes back online, and you can problem solve. Your stress reduces, and somehow it's almost like time expands. So time pressure is a really good one.
That's a great point, Aniko. And I'm going to be really honest. When I was younger, through my teens, early 20s, I found a lot of this stuff very, I guess I was resistant to the concepts of, you know, using, you know, that self-talk to change your emotional state entirely. And I kind of didn't think it was effective. But I find that kind of thing to be extremely effective. And particularly, for instance, if I'm stressed, if I'm running late or if something's going wrong, you know, with my patient, I slow right down, and I do a similar thing with self-talk and try to then control my emotions more than anything else. And I find that it's extremely effective. So I really encourage people, because if you're a graduate or a student, you know all about it. You're going to run late. You're going to have patients waiting for you, and you're going to feel bad about that. And that can affect your performance, and it can make you even slower. It can make you make mistakes. So that is, I think that's fantastic advice and really important.
Absolutely, David. And that brings me to another point, which I very much advocate and teach, and that is be your own cheer squad. Because what happens is that we berate ourselves. Oh, you stupid idiot. I used to talk to myself like that. I have tended to be a perfectionist.
Yes, and of course, we all?
You want to do the best you can, but being a perfectionist means that you're forever failing against your very high impossible standard. So I'm not saying that people shouldn't strive to be as good as they can be. However, to keep regularly reassuring yourself and say you're doing really well, sweetheart. What I had to learn, it was very difficult because I was a master whipper of myself and I was my greatest inner critic. And then I learned to talk to myself as if I was talking to my six-year-old daughter who fell over and hurt her knee. And I wouldn't berate her. I would kiss her knee better. And I'd say, sweetheart, you know, these things happen. I wouldn't call her silly for falling over. And I started talking to myself, well done, sweetheart. And I do this to this day. And I pat myself on the shoulder and I say, well done. Perhaps next time we could try this or that and do it in a different way. But you've done really well. Good on you. And that's called being your own cheer squad. And these days especially, and I know on Facebook, for example, some very, very experienced master dentists post these amazing clinical cases with photographs. And against that, a young dentist will think, oh, my God, my work is not good enough.
Absolutely.
You might want to learn with them, but just congratulate yourself for doing as you're doing the best you can and keep doing the best you can. And acknowledge yourself for it. And that, as you know, David, it makes such a difference.
So important. You raise that point that comes up all the time about Facebook and Instagram and what we see and how we then compare ourselves. Some people will be down on themselves about that, but you would never treat someone else that way. If you saw your own case in someone else's hands, you would support them in improving. You would be supportive, encouraging. But we don't treat ourselves that way for some reason. And it's something that when we take a step back and think about that, that can make a massive difference. I fully agree. And I think you're hitting some important points. And I'm glad the listeners are hearing this stuff because I think it makes a massive difference too. And I'm really glad you shared that. And I really appreciate what you have shared with us, Eneko, and your time. Obviously, we've been going for quite a while. I want to ask you just a couple last questions. And these always come back to advice for graduates. I want you to think back to the time where you graduated. And now knowing what you know, and I can imagine what you might say, but what would you tell yourself when you graduated to help your career or help yourself through those years?
That's a very good question, David. The first thing I would say is be gentle with perfectionism.
Yes, good point.
Do the best you can and congratulate yourself for doing whatever you can. Find good mentors and spend time with dentists who are patient and kind to share their own experiences. Don't spend any time around anybody who is putting you down and doesn't make you feel good. If you find yourself in a practice where it's a toxic environment, where you're not appreciated, where you're not treated kindly, even though good practices, a job is not so easy to find, I say leave, because I have spoken to a few young dentists who have stayed in such practices and it's been very demoralizing and to pick up the pieces is much harder. So take your time and find the right work environment.
Mm.
And keep on talking to patients. Your best way to build your practice is to develop good rapport with your patients and let your patients get that you really care about them and that you come from recommending what you would have done yourself. So I always took my time, first of all, to face the patient. What I've seen often, David, is that dentists get their patient, a new patient, or even an existing patient. In no time, the patient is lying back. The dentist is sitting behind them. It's a one up, one down setup, and the patient is already feeling vulnerable. I would always talk to my patients in front of them. Yes. I tended to always go out and get them from the waiting room. It's just a really lovely way of welcoming them. And I always treat my patients as if they were a visitor in my home. And then I would talk with them. I would then ask permission and let them know that I'm going to put the chair down. And I always let them know what was about to happen, what sounds they would hear. You're going to hear the sound of suction in a moment, and then you will feel a bit of pressure. Let me know anytime we are outside your comfort zone. And that's another area I'm so glad I thought of mentioning is, and this was one of my master conversational hypnosis trainers from America, a dentist who said, and I was only, I think, 25, very young dentist, and she said to me, Aniko, listen to every word that comes out of your mouth that's fear producing and remove it. And so when dentists will say things like, oh, well, this will just be a little prick, or this will hurt only for a short time, or oh, you won't like me for this. I hear this quite a lot. Immediately, the patient's body is flooded with stress hormones, and then even a light touch with a cotton roll is going to be painful. So instead, I filtered out every single word that was fear-producing, and I would say things like, it is really important to me that you're comfortable. And if at any, you know, if you say, put your hand up when it hurts, well, they're waiting for the hurt, and stress hormones are being released. So I would say, and let us know anytime when we are not within your comfort zone. So comfort zone was the way. And that your comfort is really important. And you will feel intense pressure for a moment instead of, I wouldn't use pain. And I would talk in that way. And when patients learn that things are not going to come at them unexpectedly, or some sound will come on unexpectedly, they don't have to be on high alert. But if the chair goes down unexpectedly, if suddenly the drill and the suction comes on, they are on high alert. So keeping them informed and carrying on this little conversation, which was partly distracting, partly informing them, dropping my voice tone, taking those audible breaths. And you can see the multidimensional rapport building, getting them to trust, relaxing them. And all of that combined, for any young dentist, you will have patients where you won't even know where to fit them in. That's the way you build the practice, as well as continuing clinical training.
As well as feeling good about what you do, because those patients are happy and comfortable. And those points you raise there are so important. And I try to use as much of that as I can. And I guess it's just really about recognizing what the patient's going through in a situation when they probably don't really want to be there. But what we say and absolutely what we do will impact on them and how they experience it. They'll feel more pain if they're uneasy. So that's really fantastic advice, Aniko. I really appreciate your time. And I think there's so much in this that graduates and students out there are going to get from this. I appreciate it so much. I just want to share, of course, that you know all this stuff you've talked about is coming from your passion to help young students, graduates, dentists in their posture and in their well-being as well. And a lot of this is run through optimumdentalposture.com and your courses that you run with that as well. So I encourage anyone who's listening to check that out and perhaps to go to a course. You may see me there. It sounds like something I'd like to do. I really appreciate your time, Aniko. Thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And if there's anyone listening who is able to get me into dental school so that I can train dental students very early on in the student clinic in practical training, I would love that opportunity. That's when we should start.
Absolutely. That is when we should start. Aniko, that's a great point. And I hope someone is listening. I'll pass on your information if anyone reaches out. Thank you so much. Have a great day. All right. That was Dr. Aniko Ball. I really found this chat valuable and I hope you did too. Obviously, we chatted about posture, and those things are so important. That's the flagship of what Eneco is trying to teach and change for young and older dentists. But I got a lot of information or value out of what she was talking about with stress management for both patients and yourself. And I like the way she talks about perio with her patients, or scaling and cleaning and not using the word clean, as well as the concept around smoke alarm for stress management. The way of realizing that you are starting to go off track and getting yourself back on and changing your mindset really early on. I think that's impactful stuff. So thank you, Eneco, for sharing that with us on the Dental Head Start podcast. And thank you for listening. If you want to hear more or keep in touch with Dental Head Start, please find us on Facebook and on Instagram at Dental Head Start. Of course, you can check out our stuff, our show notes, all at the website, dentalheadstart.com, where you can also sign up for the weekly newsletter of what we're releasing. And you'll get a free PDF with some metaphors that I find really useful in private practice. So check that out at dentalheadstart.com. And of course, thank you to our sponsor, BOQ Specialists, for supporting the Dental Head Start podcast and supporting dental students. Next episode, we'll have some exciting news about another partnership. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm looking forward to the next episode. We'll catch you then.